So welcome everyone. Tonight I want to teach from the four nutriments. But before we get into the four nutriments, we always begin, for those who are new, we always begin with questions and answers. Well, we always begin with questions, hopefully. Some reasonable answer. So if anybody has any just questions about the practice, sitting practice, walking practice, mindfulness practice, and especially in terms of bringing it into to one's daily life, to shine light on those areas of our life where there isn't harmony and well-being and happiness, and how we can use the practice of mindfulness and looking deeply to facilitate our own transformation. So if anybody has any questions in terms of practice, please, or anything in past weeks that wasn't clear, please feel free to ask a question. I didn't see you all the way back there, and if you see you in front all these years.
The last Dharma talk, when you were teaching the Dogen, I recall the question the Dogen from the student was, well, first it was, how do you practice? He said something to the effect that you practice emptiness, or practice emptiness. And then he was asked, well, when do you practice? He said all the time. And in thinking on that, it occurred to me that practicing emptiness when there's suffering seems to be something that comes to mind pretty easily, but practicing emptiness when things are good might be a little harder. And is that what Dogen meant by practicing all the time? Do we practice it good times and bad times?
Did he say emptiness or impermanence?
I'm sorry, impermanence.
I mean, I like emptiness too. Get these guys all mixed up. Either way. Well, impermanence is because of emptiness, so they do go together. But he was talking, if I remember, it was just a small section that had two parts. One was having the mind that seeks the way, how important it is to cultivate that mind that seeks on a consistent basis its own liberation from suffering, and how that having that part of our life is important. And then the other thing, the second part, was about impermanence, I believe. And I think what he, in my recollection, what he was in, and it ties in with what you're saying, he was saying, you know, impermanence is not just something to contemplate. It's not just an abstract contemplation, something that we think about abstractly. So all of a sudden we have a new concept called everything is impermanent, or everything is changing, and we kind of put that in our belief system. And he was saying, no, impermanence is the reality of what's happening right in front of you. Right? And therefore, one should look for impermanence, not just as a conceptual meditation or analytical meditation about the nature of change, but to see it. Right? And I think that ties in with what you're saying. We tend to, you know, it's interesting. You know, we could say, I don't know how far this this analogy or metaphor will go, but it's sort of like, you know, you have a toolbox, right? And with that toolbox, you know, you can make a doghouse. Or you can make a one-bedroom shack, or you can make something quite elaborate and beautiful. And so it's, you know, it's probably a lot of it the same set of tools and a lot of the same set of skills, but the intention and the aspiration is very different in terms of what one actually creates with it. And I think it's the same way with these teachings and practices that we are acquainting ourselves with. You know, developing the capacity to be more mindful, to be more present, developing the capacity to be more focused in one's life, learning teachings about letting go and acceptance, you know, things. I mean, I could go on and on, right? But they certainly have the possibility of making our life easier, making our life more comfortable, and obviously alleviating a fair degree of the self-induced suffering, you know that we create for ourselves. So in that sense, the teachings of Buddhism, the teachings of Dharma, etc., can be just used as kind of new strategies, right? That we can use to help us in our life when there's a lot of pain and suffering. And so, obviously, to use like the teachings on impermanence, you know, everything is changing, nothing has any substance, everything is just arising of causes and conditions, you know, we might tend to want to bring that to mind when the causes and conditions that are arising are not pleasant, right? So therefore, to remind ourselves this will change and this is suffering is only produced by causes and conditions, and when causes and conditions change, it will change, and therefore I need to let go of it, can help me deal with every suffering and difficult situation I'm dealing with. But as Andy says, but how about the other side? How about when things are going well, when I'm happy? Right? How about when the relationship is going well? How about when I'm getting my needs met? How about when things are working out for me, right? Well, what about then? Because we know we tend to kind of cross our fingers at that point. Right? And say, this isn't bad. This is quite good. And kind of go with it for as long as it lasts. But Andy's right. This too is impermanent. And even our positive mind states and positive experiences can become sources of suffering to us. Why? Because they will change. They will change. And the causes and conditions that support this situation where there's now happiness or well-being, again, a lot of it is because it's meeting our expectations of how things should be, will change, because that is just the nature of things. And so therefore, the capacity to see that anything that arises, any mind state, any experience, any condition in the world, is totally predicated by causes and conditions that are inherently unstable. And as the causes and conditions change, they will change, means equally for good mind states, quote-unquote, good mind states, quote-unquote, bad mind states, quote-unquote, happy mind states, quote-unquote, unhappy mind states. So obviously our own capacity not to grasp, not to cling, not to in any way hold on to any mind state is really the teaching. It's a deeper teaching, right? It's a deeper teaching than simply always using the Buddha's teaching to facilitate what we already do, which is we always are manipulating life to get it to somehow go our way. Right? And it's very hard when we get the tools of Dharma not to use it in the service of the self, which is always trying, struggling to find some place of comfort. And it's understandable. But then we all know that that place of comfort, that place of ease, as long as it's predicated on external causes and conditions, will change. And it's not because we're screwed up. Well, it has probably something to do with how screwed up we are. But it's not because we're bad or wrong or do, you know, it's because that is just the nature of it. And so the deeper piece that Dharma offers us is the piece that comes from understanding that all mind states are conditioned, and therefore we are not to cling to any of them. It doesn't mean when pleasure or enjoyment is present to us, we can enjoy it, but we don't cling to it. We don't make a big deal about it. We don't try to hold on to it. We don't, you know, most people, we're always pushing and pulling. You know, we're trying to grab in good experiences, and once they come in, we're trying to hold on to them, you know, and we're trying to push out the bad ones or keep the bad ones from coming, and we spend all our energy in this kind of manipulation, which is exhausting. And not only is it exhausting, but it doesn't work. So we inherently get frustrated. The capacity to let go, to deeply let go, and to simply develop the capacity to be open and present to whatever arises, and then to learn to, in our encounter with phenomena, just to be skillful, right, in the arising and passing away of things. But again, as the great Master Dogen said, impermanence is a phenomena that is always present to us in reality. And so what we were saying is, whatever arises, we watch it pass away. So, right? So not only with sickness, old age, and death, and changes, and that, do we say, oh, there is impermanence. But also when we see good things arise, happiness arise, we know, you know, it wasn't like this yesterday. Because, you know, I'm enjoying a meal, but I might not have enjoyed my breakfast. Right? The weather's the way I want. You know, a few days ago, we really enjoyed the weather, didn't we? I don't know, in St. Pete, we had some cool breezes for a little while. It was quite wonderful. But then it's what? It's hot again. So we can make a big deal about it. We can cling to one and push away the other. Or we can just note, all weather phenomena is impermanent. That's just the way it is. And when we see it like that, we have the capacity of enjoying everything. As the great Zen master said, when told to reveal the deepest truth of Zen, he simply said, in summer I sweat, in winter I shiver. It's expressing that same truth. I don't stand in opposition to life. Cold, I'm cold. When it's hot, I'm hot. What deeper truth is that than that? You know, we make a big deal about that. We have a story about everything that goes on in our life. You know, if we let go of the story and the drama and the big deal, our life becomes very simple. And I think quite wonderful. Just when we have the capacity of whatever is going on, whatever is arising, just to be present, to be aware, to be open, to deal with it as it is, and then just move on to the next one. Life becomes a much more meaningful that way for us. Much more simple, much more direct. We may feel a little strange without the drama, without the story, without having to always do you know what I mean? It's just people, you know, we're all like that, but, you know, it's like whenever you ask them, you know, what's going on, they have a story for you, but so what for a lot of them, you know, and I don't think it's demean our stories, it's like, yeah, I mean, you know, we all have lives, right? And we all have things that are going on in our life and things that are going on in the lives of the people we're involved in, and that's just life, right? It is what it is. Sometimes when friends come over, rather than talking story, you know, let me tell you my story, you tell me your story. Right? I'll share my drama, then you can share your drama. you know, why don't we just enjoy a cup of tea together? Go outside and look at the moon together. Right? You know what I mean? Or share deeply about who we are and what's really going on with us. But we're so used to storytelling, but not like in a meaningful way, just kind of repeating the stories of what's going on. So this one was that one. Again, I'm understanding in terms of relationships. You haven't seen somebody to ask you about what's going on and what's going on with the kids and what's going on with this one. But that's part of the relationship. But I think there's something deeper that we can involve ourselves with each other, know ourselves and experience ourselves at a deeper level. But I may be totally wrong. Any other questions? So I wanted to share tonight. For those who've been around a while, we know that in the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition, there in the teachings on right conduct, the mindfulness trainings, in the fifth mindfulness trainings, kind of the fifth one, traditionally, in the fifth mindfulness training, the fifth Buddhist precept, traditionally dealt with simply the use of intoxicants, and basically about things that cloud the mind, and to make the commitment not to use and abuse those kinds of things that cloud the mind, but to keep it clear at all times. In the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition, he's really brought it into the whole realm of consumption. And what's often referred to here are what are called the four nutriments. This is what I want to talk to you today. And he also talks about, understand that a proper diet is crucial for transformation of the society. And if one's not familiar with what he's talking about, one might think that's like a food diet. And it sounds a little strange, right? I understand that a proper diet is crucial for transformation of society. I mean, a proper diet may be good for one's health, but it may not be crucial for one's own transformation of society. So what he's referring to is a bigger diet in terms of these four nutrients. So I wanted to talk about that tonight because I think they are interesting and worth looking at. So this is the Buddha speaking. And it's called Discourse on the Four Kinds of Nutriments, and it's from the book Chanting from the Heart, Buddhist Ceremonies and Daily Practices by Thich Nhat Hanh and the monks and nuns of Plum Village. Plum Village is his residential community in France. This is what I heard one time when the Buddha was in the Anathapindika monastery in the Jetta Grove near the town of Shravasti. Those of us who went on pilgrimage together this past January were there. We were in Anathapindika's monastery in the Jetta Grove in Shravasti. So we can tell you that it's not made up. And again, we all know that a Buddhist sutra, which purports to be the direct teaching of the Buddha, we know it's a sutra because it always begins with this is, or thus is what I heard, or this is what I heard, because what that refers to is that it was several centuries after the Buddha's passing that his teachings were passed on orally, and so therefore after the Buddha's passing, at the first Buddhist councils and subsequent ones. The way they would authenticate, right, what is a Buddhist teaching, what the Buddha said and what he didn't say, because one of his very close disciples, such as his attendant Ananda, brothers who had been with him consistently, would say, I heard the Buddha say this, right? I'm not making this up. This is what I heard him say in such and such a situation. So basically, this kind of this is what I heard, and naming the place and the time and the situation, the protagonist is usually meaning this is, you know, this really happened. Now, whether this really happened, we could talk about this another time. But basically, in the Buddhist tradition, this is considered to be a transmission of what the Buddha said. That day, the Buddha told his monks, quote, unquote, "There are four kinds of nutriments which enable living beings to grow and maintain life. What are these four nutriments? The first is edible food. The second is the food of sense impressions. The third is the food of volition. And the fourth is the food of consciousness." Now we will now go into that. But again, I think we can see that in any spiritual teaching, the teacher is always trying to open us up, right? To see the larger picture, right? To understand things more deeply. And so here he's taking nutriment, which for most of us we would go, oh, I know nutriment. It has to do with food, right? Things I eat. Yeah, that's what, you know. And we might say, yeah, you know, I've read a book on nutrition. Right? I know what's good for me to eat and what's not good for me to eat. But all of a sudden the Buddha's going, oh, that's just one kind of nutriment. There are other kinds of nutriments. And as some people such as us who are concerned about transformation, we want not simply the transformation of our physical body, but most importantly the transformation of our mind, we're interested. Oh, it's not only the body that needs nutrition, and that there is a science in the nutrition, but it's also the mind, the senses, that we need to attend to. So the Buddha begins, he says, bhikkhus. Bhikkhus is the Sanskrit word, Pali word, for monks. It's called bhikkhus. Bhikkhus, how should a practitioner regard edible food? Then he tells a fairly extreme story about a young couple with a child that they raised with love, and they one day they had to go to different places to earn their living, and one time they had to cross with their son a desert, and during this crossing the desert, for one reason or another, they lost all their food stores and were starving. And there seemed to be no way out of their situation. They were too far away from any food source. So they said, well, the husband and wife said to each other, "We only have one son whom we love with all our heart. If we eat his flesh, we shall survive and manage to overcome this dangerous situation. If we do not eat his flesh, all three of us will die." So, I mean, I'm not going to get into this one, but it's obviously, we can imagine for parents, right, one of the most painful kind of choices or decisions one would ever be faced with. Right? I mean, it's kind of beyond courses in ethics and morals when we're given these kinds of conundrums. It is deeply disturbing. But anyhow, after their discussion, with tears of pain and gritting of their teeth, they did slay their son. And they did eat his flesh so they could live, or at least the two of them could live and come out of the desert. So I guess this must have been a story that must have been current. In the Buddhist society of that time. And the Buddha said to his monks, he said, "Do you think the couple ate their son's flesh because they wanted to enjoy its taste and because they wanted their bodies to have the nutriment so they could be more beautiful?" And the monks replied, no. The Buddha said, or asked, "Were the couple forced to eat their son's flesh in order to survive and escape from the dangers of the desert?" And the monk said, "Yes." So the Buddha taught. And again, I just want to preface this. He is teaching monastics. And you've often heard me say when I get into the Buddha's teaching that the Buddha's teaching was always in relationship to who he was teaching. And when he was teaching monastics, basically people who had renounced the world, he gave different teachings than when he taught lay people who were totally involved in the world. Very different teachings. So we understand here he's teaching monks who live very sparse, Spartan lives, and they live a life of renunciation. They renounce the things of the world. So he says, and again, so we can talk about how what this might mean to us. He says, monks, every time we ingest edible food, we should train ourselves to look at it as our own son's flesh. If we meditated on this way, we shall have clear insight and understanding, which puts an end to misperceptions about edible food, and our attachments to sensual pleasures will dissolve. Once the attachment to sensual pleasures is transformed, there are no longer any internal formations concerning the five objects of sensual pleasure in the noble disciple who applies himself to the training and the practice. When the internal formations still bind us, we have to keep returning to this world. Now that's a mouthful. So let's start to see what the Buddha is up to. So he tells a story, right? About this couple who only to survive, right, eat the flesh of their child. It's not about pleasure. It's not about enhancing the beauty of their body. It's not about taste. It's simply about food is necessary for survival. And so he is telling us, you know, that's really what food's about. Right? He's reminding us. And as lay people, we have to be reminded because if we don't, we can get very much caught up into what? That food becomes all about taste. Right? And therefore, we become people who make an incredible big deal, you know, the uber gourmet people, the uber gourmand lifestyle, where everything's about taste and color and sensuality. Or else it all becomes about my body. Now, why does the Buddha warn us about that? Right? I mean, why does he ruin our party? Why does he ruin our pleasure? And again, I think again, as lay people, we can find the middle way in all this, because the Buddha way. For lay people is really a path where there are all the extremities are cut off and we find the middle way. And in a certain way, while it may seem more difficult what he's suggesting to his monks, in a way it's an easier way, isn't it? Because if you always, if you live in a monastery and you eat your rice and your vegetables and and everything is like that, and your food is always prepared for you, in a certain way, it's all kind of laid out, right? And you just go along with it. And so, in a certain way, your attachments and your pleasures are much more narrow. But as lay people, or especially like lay people such as ourselves in a society where there is lots of choices, we have to be more careful. We have to be more self-reliant in finding that middle way. It's just that, and it's really for two reasons. On one hand, it's not that we just end up focusing so much energy and time around food. And we do that, don't we? Right? I mean, food is big in our society. I mean, there's cable TV channels. It's just about food. Right? There's endless books just about food. Preparing food. There's endless books about diets. Right? We are obsessed with food. Anyway, you understand that, as well as we have eating disorders. So it's significant, the role that food plays. And as we say, human beings have the capacity, because of their grasping and their misperceptions, to take something which is fairly benign in and of itself, and we turn it into a source of suffering. It tastes so good, we eat so much. We don't stop. Even though we know this food doesn't agree with us, we still eat it because it tastes so good going down for the first few minutes. Things that are even labeled. Did we talk about this here? Junk food? No. I think that's incredible. Right? The food is even, we call it junk food. I mean, we all know it's junk. It's filler. It has no nutritional value. Right? It's just a totally made up, manufactured, processed kind of thing that very sophisticated people have put together. Because why? Because it appeals to our taste buds, but it has no nutritional value. And yet we what? We just wolf it down. Even though it's junk. So the Buddha reminds us. And I think there's also an interesting thing here, that he uses a story connected to flesh. Because, in truth, we are eating living things, aren't we? I mean, I'm not just even talking about meat and fish and chicken and promoting vegetarianism, but even when we eat vegetables and fruits and nuts, I mean, these are living things. You know, we can talk about some are more complex than others, and some have consciousness. You know what I mean? There's lots to be said about it. You know, in that sense. But these are living things. Something, whether it's animal or fish, bird, whether it's a plant, you know, it was alive before it was killed. It was alive before it was picked. It is the flesh of something. And to know that, I think, is very humbling. And I think it also increases our capacity to eat with some sense of reverence. That, you know, whether it's a living being, or whether it was a grain, something did give up its life so we can live. And again, we don't have to make a big deal about it. But I think it's important that we have that kind of awareness that we are surviving because something has given up its life for us. And that sense of relationship to what we are eating, and that type of awareness that many things have occurred before that came to our bowl or our plate. As I said, it gives us a little sense of sacredness in terms of eating, but also makes us aware of interconnection. To really understand that all these things that are in our plate and bowl and that we're eating today are coming from many, many different sources and different people. And we eat with that kind of awareness. In the same way that, I mean, it's hard to say, but you know, those parents were eating their child's flesh, they there was an understanding there that of this connection. So this is the first, right? Say that the path of the monk and nun is a path of renunciation. The path of the lay person is a path of understanding. So we have to understand the nature of how attachment causes suffering. You spend hours preparing a wonderful meal. Twenty minutes, it's gone. Right. And then what? Well, a lot of dishes. Indigestion. Oh, I ate too much. Again, we want balance. We are lucky, we have lots of options, we have access to good, nutritious food. There's nothing wrong with preparing things in a tasty way, right? We don't need to make a big deal about it. We don't need to go overboard, and we don't need to be attached. Because we know that if we live for sensual pleasure, it doesn't mean that sensual pleasure is not part of life. It is. You don't have to go after it. To be alive and have senses is to encounter the world of sensation. Right? It's something you have to struggle about. You know, we have eyes, we see. We have ears, we hear. We have a nose, we smell. We have mouth, we taste. We have skin, we feel. So the capacity to be a sensual person and to be alive to sensation is always present to us from the moment we get up to the time we go to bed. We don't have to manufacture sensual experiences. Just the act of being alive is a sensual experience. And so we can appreciate our capacity to have senses and to enjoy our contact with the senses without making it into a big deal and attaching, grasping after those experiences and continually seeking them out as a source of happiness and meaning. Because that's where we will create suffering for ourselves, because there is no, other than the experience itself, there is nothing there of any substance. So we will always be having a sensual experience that we're running after. It'll always dissipate very quickly. We'll be left with a feeling of emptiness, which will cause us to continue to seek more and more and more. And you're in this endless cycle. So the Buddha says, just look deeply. So, edible food. Now the next he calls the food of sense impressions. So, we have eyes that see, ears that hear, right? These are the five senses. And we also have a mind that thinks. Thoughts, feelings, perceptions, memories appear to the mind. So what the Buddha is now going to suggest is our senses are another way, like food enters our digestive system, becomes part of our body when we eat it. In the same way, our mind is conditioned by our sensual experience. This is very important. And he says, imagine a cow which has lost its skin. Again, these are, we lived in agricultural society. So, images about cows may not be that, unless you come from Wisconsin or something. Imagine a cow which has lost its skin. Wherever it goes, the insects and maggots which live in the earth, in the dust, and on the vegetation, attach themselves to the cow and suck its blood. The Buddha was quite vivid. The lads with parents eating their children's flesh. Anyhow. Attach themselves to the cow and suck its blood. The cow lies on the earth. The maggots in the earth will attach themselves to it and feed off it. Whether lying down or standing up, the cow will be irritated and suffer pain. When you ingest the food of the sense impressions, you should practice to see it in this light. You will have insight and understanding, which puts an end to misperceptions concerning the food of sense impressions. When you have this insight, you will no longer be attached to the three kinds of feelings. Three kinds of feelings, which is really about, this is not feelings meaning emotion, this is feelings in the sense of Buddhist psychology, which is every time a sense contacts an object of the sense, that these are a positive feeling, a negative feeling, or a neutral feeling. So these are the three kinds of feelings. When you're no longer attached to the three kinds of feeling, the noble disciple does not need to strive anymore, because whatever needs to be done has already been done. That's a nice phrase. So you don't have to strive anymore, because whatever needs to be done has already been done. So there's this cow who has no skin, right? And it's all its contacts with the earth and with substances, all kinds of maggots and worms are getting into it and causing it to suffer. Now, we see things. We hear things. We smell things. We taste things. We feel things. And we think things. And through these, we could say, six doors, things enter our consciousness. They create impressions. They leave an impression on our mind stream. Now, can we really say that we are aware and vigilant of what we consume with our senses? So things that do cause rotting, suffering, that don't enter our consciousness. What do we consume through our senses? Pretty much everything. When we watch a movie, there are all kinds of movies to watch, aren't there? And the impression that movie, that story, that book, that conversation, that thought, leaves an impression in our mind. And whether that impression is something that ennobles us, whether that impression is something that is congruent with the type of mind we want to be developing, or whether it's the opposite, is what he's talking about. When we are angry, we're consuming what? Angry. When we are afraid, we are consuming fear. When our mind is critical and judgmental, we are consuming that. When we're always looking out, desiring, wanting things that appear to our senses, we're consuming greed, neediness, So again, please understand that the Buddha is not suggesting, you know, that we wear blinders and we cover our ears and cover our nose. And, right? I mean, that's one way, isn't it? It's a path of renunciation, asceticism. But it means, please understand, that what we are consuming through our senses is very effective. Now, I just spent some time just now talking about the negatives. But we also can be very aware that we have the capacity of consuming through our senses things that are beautiful. When we see something that is beautiful, right, such as when we see each other, it can make us what? The impression it can leave. When we see a flower, when we see a sunset, when we go out tonight and see the full moon, we are consuming things that give us a peaceful mind, give us a happy mind. So this understanding that we are consuming the same way we're eating food with our mouth, and that is affecting the quality of our physical health and well-being, in the same way we are consuming through our sense organs experiences one after the other, and that is affecting us positively and negatively. I mean, I think these days we often consume a lot of ugliness, don't we? Right? Oftentimes, listening to the news and just listening to what? I mean, you know, the internationals, but the local news, which is always filled with what?
Violence.
Negativity. It's always, right, killings and violence and weird stuff. And, you know, that's what all it's about, isn't it? Now, what is the impression that's leaving in our mind? There is a residue of experience. And so again, if we become very attentive to our experience, to our sensory experience, including the mind, and understand, you know, I am consuming experience. And what am I giving them? You know, am I giving my experience junk? Right? We talk about junk food. Junk food, we say, is what? Food that has no nutritional value. It's just filler. Right? It just takes up space. It fills me up, but there's nothing nutrition. How much of our experience during the day, how much of the things we do are the same? They're junk. You know, maybe we could talk about junk experiences. Experiences that have no substance, that just take up time, fill up space. Right? You know, we have words for it, right? Like channel surfing and internet surfing. You know, just taking up space. I'm just spending minutes, hours. Did you see anything that you really enjoyed? You know, made you happy? Was really good? Gave you strong, you know, I mean, it was a good experience. I mean, not to say that you can't have good experiences on TV or with movies on the internet, but, you know, how aware are we from as we go through our day? Conversations. And we talked about it earlier, right? How in our conversations with each other. How often do we have junk conversations? You know what I mean? There's no substance there. We're just passing time. We're kind of like, you know, half awake, telling stories to each other. They really have no meaning. Some people just talk. You'll be around those kind of people. you talk. It's almost like all you could do is just keep nodding, and every now and then, oh, 5, 10, 15 minutes, you know, as long as you kind of don't fall asleep, they'll keep talking. Right? And I don't set that to be critical, but just to say there's just a lot of living that's just junk. There's no nutrition there. Nutrition for our souls. You know, people just pass time. What do they do? They're not cruising. People go shopping. Just for what? Just to pass time. Just another kind of junk experience. I just know somebody, they always took everything back. They go out shopping, they come back with these things, the next day, 3 days later, they take everything back. It's like, because they just enjoyed the shopping. And then they were never satisfied the next day with what they got. Again, it's not to say we're not human beings and we don't have our idiosyncrasies. We're less than perfect. But in the same way, I think the Buddha is suggesting that in the same way, that's what's most obvious to us around food, we can really see that more clearly. But again, when we get into this area of senses and experience, I think this is an eye-opener. These next two I'll do next time, because they're really worth spending time in. But in the same way, in the fifth mindfulness training, which is just about, alcohol and drugs and keeping the mind clear, not bringing these toxins into our consciousness, we know that all these things we just talked about, these experiences, these conversations, these movies, these books, they can be toxic too. just because we're not drinking and we're not doing drugs doesn't mean we're still not taking toxins. We're still not poisoning our consciousness. Things that are toxic for us. And that's important to remember. That's what I often tell people. The AA movement and the NA movement, are for very specific kinds of addicts. The Buddhist path is kind of for the general human addictions. it's like a 12-step program for everybody. Right. Because we're all addicted to things that are not healthy for us. And we're all using substances that are causing suffering to ourselves and others. But at the same time, let me end on a positive note, we all have the capacity, when we see cause and effect, when we're willing to look at the consequences of certain level kinds of consumption, of whether it's food or sensory experience, to know I have the capacity of what? Of eating things that are good for my body, right? That are healthy, that are nutritious, that are good for my cells, that are good for my longevity, right? I have that capacity. It's not that big a deal to figure that out. Right? In the same way, we have the capacity for consuming experiences that create happiness and well-being and ease and peace of mind and beauty and all these things and laughter. There's all kinds of music today that's violent, right? There's all kinds of music that's very uplifting, makes us happy. So when we know that, then we understand, if I want to be a peaceful person, if I want to have a peaceful mind, if I want to have a beautiful soul, then I have to consume things that create that. In the same way, I cannot have a healthy body if I, eat my three meals a day at McDonald's and supplement it with Cheez-Its. Cheez-Its or whatever. it doesn't happen. You know what I mean? And we understand that, unless we're really deluded. Right? We understand that. So in the same way, we need to look very carefully at the whole realm of our experience in that same way. And if we want to be healthy in mind and body, then we have to pay very clear attention to our consumption in these areas. So why don't we stop here? The next two has to do with volition and consciousness. So we'll deal with that when I come back in 2 weeks. Any question about anything that's been that we shared tonight? Everything clear? Thank you. I mean, interesting, right? Just in that, you know, 2,500 years ago, right? And yet the teaching still, so relevant and meaningful. Yeah, so is your human experience, even though it looks very different, at its core is the same. People still dealing with the same kind of issues. Excuse me. Thank you for coming tonight.